All right, good morning, golfers. Welcome to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. Thank you for joining us on Saturday, October 15th, 2016. A little bit of a frost delay out there, but that doesn't stop my man Steve Goldman from joining the show. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing great. We've got the 2016-17 wraparound season off to a good start out in California. I'm stoked. Give me some Safeway Open.
Well, you know, the season doesn't start unless it's the back nine at Safeway Open.
That is so. That is very true. That how old is that adage, by the way?
I don't know. but pleased to be joined on the line by Golf World and The Golf Paper, an online prescription subscription-based golf paper. John Huggin, how you doing, John?
I'm very well. Nice to be with you.
Yep, always a pleasure to have you, and timely. I don't think half hour is enough time for us to review everything that we need to get over. There's so much. If we look at last year, you know, the if we looked at the majors and the Ryder Cup and the passing of Arnold Palmer and Tiger, I think we'd need a week-long show, but let's just talk a little bit about last year. Do you have a favorite moment from the majors last year?
Well, it would have to be the Open Championship at Troon, on the right end of the scale. On the wrong end of the scale, I'm afraid it would have to be the U.S. Open at Oakmont.
Yep.
And all the nonsense that went on there. But I think our Open, if I can say our Open, came along at just the right time, and it kind of restored golf's position with the kind of non-golf audience, if you like. They went from asking what the hell is going on, basically, to, man, isn't this great, in the space of 3 weeks.
Yeah, and I think the Olympics helped us get over the nonsense at the U.S. Open, given that compressed timeline. So that was really helpful.
Yes, absolutely. The Olympics, I had plenty of misgivings about the Olympics. But one of the things I wasn't worried about was the golf, and that turned out to be true. With a terrific finish and on a terrific golf course, it all worked very well.
Yeah, it was nice to see the Olympics played on a golf course and play golf the way golf was meant to be. It would have been, given all the cloud that surrounded it and all the misgivings, as you put it, around Olympic golf. If it had been a you know, aim and shoot and bomb and gouge, it would have been an awful foot forward.
Well, that's right. The golf course was actually the star of the show, as far as I was concerned. I mean, I thought Gil Hans did a terrific job with that place. And the best thing, of course, was that there was no bunkers in the rough.
Yes. Well, you know what I say? It's not golf unless you have more bunkers in the rough. I mean, you have to have bunkers in the rough. I'm not sure how that came about, actually. It's an interesting evolution of the game of golf, isn't it?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that the golf ball, and I bang on about this, I know way too much maybe, but the golf ball goes too far for the guys at the top level. So, and trying to make it more difficult, in inverted commas, the authorities have narrowed the fairways to the point where the courses don't really get played the way they were designed to be played, sadly.
Yeah.
John, you know, you brought up the U.S. Open, and of course it brings up some unfortunate memories of rules and how rules get implemented, and you know, the intrusiveness of the media and technology, and the fact that, you know, if you have a lot more cameras on somebody on, let's say, a Saturday, and he moves three grains of sand in a bunker and doesn't realize it, he's going to get penalized. But if it's Thursday and he's a nobody, and nobody's watching, then it's not a penalty. It just, you know, obviously to the casual fan, that obviously leaves a very bad taste in people's mouths about, you know, how, let's just say the USGA views the rules of golf and how they're implemented.
Well, that's right. I mean, my non-golfing friends were asking me about the US Open afterwards, and it's hard to explain to people, you know, what actually went on if they don't understand even a little bit about golf. But the two things that I think need to stem from all that nonsense was, I think if we need a high-definition camera to detect whether or not a ball has moved, you can't see it with the naked eye. I mean, I don't think it happened in reality. I think they should just move on. Plus, in the case of Dustin Johnson, I mean, he didn't actually touch the golf ball. It moved of its own volition, if you like, just because he was close by. And I think if you don't touch the ball and the ball moves, all we really have to do is put the ball back and move on. I mean, obviously it's very different if the player touches the ball, then it's a whole different scenario. But if there's no actual physical contact between the player and his club and the golf ball, and the golf ball happens to move, I'll just put the golf ball back and move on. Isn't it? It should be that simple, really.
And what was really frustrating about all that is that there was a rules official there. Dustin Johnson calls the rules official over, calls his fellow competitors over, and it seems like they adjudicate the matter right away. And then all of a sudden, you know, however many, you know, minutes later, they decide, you know, who you're going to believe. You're going to believe, you know, me or your lying eyes. And then all of a sudden they make a different decision about it.
Well, that's right. I mean, it betrays the USGA's level of pedantry, I'm afraid, and that they created the situation for themselves. As you just said, Lee Westwood, I think, was Dustin Johnson's playing partner that day, and he was fine with what went on. Dustin Johnson knew he hadn't touched the ball. The referee accepted all that, and that should have been the end of it. But unfortunately, the USGA created a situation whereby if somebody had approached Dustin Johnson on the 16th tee in the last round of the US Open, one of the four major championships in golf, and said, "Dustin, how do you stand against the rest of the field?" He didn't know. He wouldn't have had a clue as to how he stood, which is complete nonsense. The integrity of the competition was completely compromised by these daft rules officials.
And the USGA, you know, tries to insulate themselves, and they don't even you know, point the camera back at themselves and says, well, maybe if we don't go to 13.5 on the stimp meter, maybe the balls will actually stay still on the green when the players are actually ready to putt.
Exactly. You just hit the bullseye there. The problem isn't that Dustin Johnson made a practice stroke somewhere adjacent to his golf ball. The problem is the speed of the greens. They're far too fast, and if you make them like that, I mean, balls are going to move. It's physics.
And when you talk about the physics, it's fine physics. I mean, we're talking about usually when they're cut that low, you're talking about a blade of grass. It's just a piece of nature just really just collapsing. I mean, how much at that fragile state, at that height, how much pressure can it withstand? You don't have to, you know, you don't have to step within, you know, a couple of feet of it. You don't even have to step next to it. I mean, the leaves that really, it's really a leaf, cut that low, how much can they, obviously they just can't hold up. It's just a matter of time before it's going to collapse. And you know, these guys take so much time over the ball in general, and they're walking around. I'm surprised, quite frankly, it doesn't happen more often.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's the classic accident waiting to happen. And the USGA did something similar in the Women's Open in the playoff when the lady whose name escapes me for the moment was penalized because she'd moved two grains of sand that was only visible yet again with a high-definition camera.
Yeah, Anna Nordqvist, was it Anna?
Yes, yeah, yeah. And then they double up by letting the players know about the ruling,
right?
And after one has played to the last green and before the other girl had played, which again completely compromised the integrity of the competition. I mean, my goodness, the USGA did themselves no favors this year.
Yeah, they've had a a rough year, and you know, I don't know. It's just, the more and more I'm reminded of the movie of the gang that can't shoot straight, and you know, now they have more trouble with the, and when I don't have any ambition to talk about, you know, what's going on with the Trump courses and all that stuff, and it's just a lot of noise, I guess that's really what I'm saying. They seem to not, you know, where most of us like to prefer to fly under the radar, it seems impossible for the USGA to sort of stay off the radar. Every major championship, now it's the places where their golf courses are. It just can't stay within, you know, you like our rules to be sort of in the background. We like that, and you would assume the rules organization would want to be in the background as well. But the rules of golf and the action taken by the USGA continue to make themselves the story, whether they want to be the story or not.
Well, that's exactly right. And basically their problem is they take the setup of the golf course for the US Open almost every year right to the edge of sanity.
Right.
And when you get, there's so many variables involved in golf courses and golf, inevitably you're going to topple over that line sometimes, and it's happening way too often. I think the contrast, not that I'm a huge fan of the RNA in many ways, but at Troon this year, they got it right, because the weather forecast for the last day on the Sunday was really quite poor.
Right.
And they took account of that, and they moved the pins. I know they did. They moved the pins further away from the edge of the green than they would have done normally, which actually made the course play a little easier. And as it turned out, the weather wasn't as bad as they thought it might be, so the scoring on the last day, particularly from Henrik Stenson and Phil Mickelson, of course, was absolutely brilliant. And it just, I hope they learned a lesson from that, because the spectacle that we were provided with, because the golf course was set up a little bit away from the edge, if you like, was so much better than the spectacle you get routinely at the US Open every year, where, they're so close to the edge that sometimes they fall over it.
Because you would think that the golf should supersede everything else, especially when it's a major championship. And talking about the USGA, it almost, they like to be the story. They like to be part of the narrative that shapes the result of the championship, as opposed to saying, all right, we've chosen our venue, we've set up the golf course, and boy, wasn't the golf great. Wasn't it great that the best players in the world, you know, shined on Sunday, and it was great theater, as opposed to, basically, you know, we're the ones that control the outcome, or at least controlled part of the narrative that shaped the outcome.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's all about, for them, it seems to me, they're imposing their kind of warped philosophy on how golf should be played on the rest of us. And it just, I don't get it. I don't get this penal philosophy that golf is all about punishment, and you know, it's all about punishing the, as they call, bad shots. I mean, for one thing, it eliminates completely the most interesting and exciting part of golf at the top level, and that's the kind of risky recovery shot, where a player might be tempted to take on something that he maybe shouldn't, but suddenly he brings into play, if he hits the wonder shot, he brings the birdie back into play, but he also brings a double and a triple bogey back into play. But the US GA seem to, you know, they don't like that, the way of playing golf. So a guy misses the fairway, he's in this long grass, so he chops it back out to 90, 100 yards from the green, and he makes a 4 or a 5 every time. I mean, to me, that's kind of tedious. I'd rather see a form of the game where numbers from 3 to 8 come into play. Well, that seems to me far more interesting.
Well, you know what it is, John? It's just that because America has always had this pathology of excessiveness, and that's just been our nature. That's the way we are. And unfortunately, someone down the road said, well, the excessive, you know, if we want to continue our pathology, then we have to punish golfers. We can't make it easy for them. So how are we going to make it hard on them? How are we going to say that this is the best test? How are we going to make this, you know, they wanted to, it's like golf, people love watching the Packers play in the middle of winter because everything is frozen, and it's excessive, and that's why they like it, because it's excessive, and that feeds into this American pathology of being, we take things to the limit, and so what do? We grow the rough high, we make the fairways, you have to walk down single file, so because we, you know, that's just the way, that's the nature of America. It's bizarre to me that rational minds can't prevail when assessing what is good for the game and what is good for everybody. Really, you want to grow the game; it should be enjoyable to watch, to play, and watch. But talking about the pathology of American history is a little beyond our scope here. But we got to take a short break. We'll be listening. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
The Long Island Golf Association is a nonprofit organization of 81 private and public clubs. The LIGA conducts 15 championships annually and works closely with the Long Island Caddy Scholarship Fund. The scholarships are granted to young men and women who are employed at member clubs. For more information on how you can participate in a championship, or if you'd like to donate your time as a volunteer, please call the LIGA at 516-746-1015. That's 516-746-1015. 1015, or visit us at www.longislandgolf.org. Is your inspection due? Are you tired of listening to that noise your car is making? If you're looking for a reliable shop to service your car, try A1 Action Auto for all your car service needs. A1 Auto is a New York State certified shop, and owner Ed Terabile has over 25 years of experience. A1 Action Auto is conveniently located off Sunrise Highway in West Islip, so pick up the phone and call A1 Action Auto at 631-321-4242. That's 631-321-4242.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony Scorsia. He's Steve Goldman, and on the line is John Huggin from The Golf Paper and Golf World. John, let's move to, we have about 10, 12 minutes left. The unfortunate passing of Arnold Palmer. I just wanted to know, in your lifetime and in your interaction with him and just being around him, do you have a favorite Arnold Palmer story that you've been around or have heard?
Well, I think I'm not going to tell you anything new about Arnold Palmer. I mean, I think he was the ultimate people person, and certainly I can't think of anybody who's been more historically significant in the history of professional golf than Arnold. I was at the Open at St. Andrews last year when he was there. It was his last ever visit to St. Andrews and the Old Course, and I bumped into Kel Nagel's granddaughter, who was there visiting. They were kind of honouring Kel Nagel, who'd won the Centenary Open at St. Andrews in 1960. Beating Arnold by a shot, as it turned out. And she told me the story of bumping into Arnold at breakfast in the Old Course Hotel. And he, you know, she just walked up and introduced herself, and he could not have been nicer to this young lady that he'd never met before, and told her some great stories about her grandfather, and, you know, could not have been more pleasant and down to earth. And that was Arnold Palmer. I mean, he was certainly it's an old cliche, but he was the people's champion. I mean, he came along, you know, just before Jack Nicklaus. I mean, Jack Nicklaus, everyone would admit, I'm sure Arnold would too, that Jack Nicklaus was a better golfer. But God made sure that Arnold was the most loved. And he was the same everywhere. I mean, America quite rightly made a huge deal out of Arnold dying. I was in the States at the time for the Ryder Cup when he passed. But he was everybody's. I mean, he belonged to us almost as much as he did to America. And that may be the highest compliment I can ever pay him, to be honest.
John, is it fair to say that Arnold Palmer basically put the United Kingdom on the map by going to the Open Championship? And, you know, of course, it was a perfect marriage because television was in its infancy as well. But, you know, with the confluence of those two forces together, basically putting British golf on the world stage.
Well, certainly timing is everything, and the Open Championship was definitely, it seemed better times, shall we say, towards the end of the kind of late 50s before Arnold came along. I'm sure the Open would have been resurrected to something like it is today, but he certainly accelerated the process. And when he came over, it was huge news, and he, as I say, he almost won in 1960, and then he won in 1961 and in 1962. And from then on, you know, the Open Championship was a big deal. Nicklaus started to come. He came in 62. And from then on, you know, it's taken its rightful place, I think, in, as one of the four most important events in the game. But Arnold deserves enormous credit for that. You're absolutely right on that.
You mentioned the Ryder Cup. I just, a lot of people in America, again.
He did? Who won that, by the way? I almost forgot.
Well, it makes a change.
What's that?
I say it makes a change.
You know, do you think that after watching this particular iteration of the Ryder Cup, do you think the Americans have finally got it in terms of their structure, in terms of their you know, how they set things up and the sort of the management structure, if you will? You think the Americans finally get how to finally do the Ryder Cup right?
Well, they very well may have, But I don't think we can say definitively yet. I mean, it might just be that the Americans had a slightly better team than the Europeans did this year. That this was not the strongest American, European team by any means. In fact, it wasn't the best 12 European golfers as things stand right now.
Sure.
So they went into a weaker team than normal. In fact, it was almost like a throwback to the late 1980s when the top half of the European team was easily identifiable from the bottom half. That was the case this time. There was five or six guys who were always going to be strong in that team, but the bottom half, as was shown in the singles on the Sunday, wasn't nearly as good. And they also had Danny Willett, for whatever reason, wasn't playing well. Lee Westwood didn't play well either, and that was just too much for the Europeans to cope with. But you're right. I mean, the Americans may well have turned the corner in terms of the organization and identifying the best players and all the rest of it. But I don't think we can absolutely say for sure 100% until they've won maybe two or three in a row. It might just be, as I say, that they simply had a better team this year.
Hey, over there in the pond, are they hanging Darren Clark in effigy and calling for his resignation and, full-page ads? European teams got to blow it up and they've got to start over again from scratch?
Well, none of the above is true, but I don't think I do think that they need to change their system. They need to get away from this. For me, it's a daft rule that you have to be a member of the European team to be eligible for the European Tour. Obviously, they didn't have their strongest team this year because Paul Casey wasn't there. Russell Knox, who's also in the top 20 in the world, wasn't picked, which was madness. Sorry, my phone is ringing.
Uh-oh. Hang on
1 second.
That's all right.
Maybe it's Darren Clark.
It's my father-in-law looking for my wife. But anyway, that's another story. Where was I? Darren Clark. The European Tour needs to, they need to change that rule if they're going to get their best team.
Yeah.
Because it's like they're going to need their best team going forward to beat the Americans. Because, as you just pointed out, if the Americans get their act in gear and start identifying their best team, the Europeans are not going to win unless they've got their 12 best players on the field.
Yeah, without question. I think, I don't think, to be fair, Darren Clark, I mean, you could have questioned some of his pairings, to some degree, but I don't even think that was particularly fair considering the timing. There was a lot of things that went on that I think the system probably failed him as much as maybe his pairings in terms of when you, like you said, in terms of being a member of the European Tour and yada, yada, yada. But let's get to the probably the biggest story this week and Tiger Woods in the last couple minutes we have together. And I really just have one question. Steve and I were speaking way before he withdrew, and I was informing him that, there were reports that Tiger was getting out of the cart very gingerly at the Ryder Cup, and he wasn't bouncing around the golf course like a spring chicken. Not that he's anywhere close to being a spring chicken, but not like a healthy spring chicken anyway. And I guess my question to you was, and I'm certain you nobody really knows the answer but Tiger, but why? I guess my only question is, why commit? Is it part of the procedure? Yes. But, the Ryder Cup wasn't that long ago. If you were having difficulty managing your back then, what changed in a week or so, that you were so much that you could commit? And then what happened in 3 days that makes you, withdraw? It just all seemed very strange to me.
Well, me too. I mean, baffles me is that he's changed the narrative here. He could have, walked away from the game quite happily, saying that, his body really wasn't up to the task after all the back problems and the knee operations and all the rest of it. That would all have been perfectly legitimate reasons for not playing at the top level anymore, but he's kind of given that up.
Yeah.
By saying he's practicing hard, I'm working hard, I'm close, I'm this, I'm that. So we're now thinking, oh, well, now he can play, and now, as you say, because he commits to the tournament, then withdraws in the space of a couple of days, you start to think, well, there's other reasons. I mean, my theory is that the chipping yips reared their ugly head again. And if, to be perfectly honest, and I take no pleasure in this, if he's got chipping yips, he's finished. It's as simple as that. He cannot play at the top level with that affliction. As been shown over the years, there have been plenty of players have had that problem. And if Tiger's got that, I'm afraid to say it's over.
Well, especially because when he withdrew, he didn't even cite a physical reason why he withdrew. It's to your point. It's about the golf. And I'm thinking, well, doesn't he know if his game, especially his short game, is at a place where he could compete? And, you know, is it, maybe in his mind's eye, he says, yeah, I can, you know, it's not there yet, but I'll get it there. And by the time the Safeway Open comes around, I'll be ready to play. And then suddenly 3 days before he says, well, no, I can't. But I mean, you know, I would think as a professional golfer, don't you know where the state of your game is?
Well, the language that he chose to use in the statement when he withdrew, he used the word vulnerable. And that made me think, my mind went straight to the chipping yips when he said that. That is not a normal golfing term, if you like. And to use that word made me think that there's a serious problem somewhere in his game. And as we've seen before, the chipping has left him and come back, and maybe it's gone again, because that's the only thing I can think of that would make him withdraw only like 2 days after he committed to the tournament. Something drastic must have happened very quickly. And the chipping yips is the most likely scenario.
I mean, this is a man who isn't afraid of anything. I mean, this guy won the U.S. Open with a torn ACL, for crying out loud. So, I mean, you're right. It's very telling, and I'm very curious to see moving forward, you know, what tournament he chooses to play and whether or not he can overcome whatever he thinks he's trying to overcome.
Well, it's a curious word. In general, in golfing terms, as John said, but it's also a curious word for Tiger. In his past, that's not a word he would use in the past. And to John's point, not only has he changed the narrative, but he's also now up the ante on the pressure for when he does come back. So if it is the yips, we've only now just piled it on to now where he's basically, you know, I don't even know if he can come back from, I mean, I really don't at this point, because of the amount of pressure now. He's just turned up the heat on the pressure. You agree, John, or no?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I'm surprised that he's even trying, because
right, exactly.
He's not going to be the Tiger Woods that we all remember back in the day. I mean, Tiger Woods played golf better than anybody has ever played golf. And if I was him, I'm not sure that I would have the inclination or the motivation, or however you want to put it, to come back and be just another guy and maybe win, you know, once every couple of years at best. I mean, if I'm Tiger Woods, I'm not interested in that scenario, and I would have walked away. I would have taken the easy out and cited the injuries and the back stuff and said, you know, I'm sorry, I can't do it anymore. Thanks very much. I'm off.
I agree 110%. It would have been but then again, there, Tiger and the PR team has never really done, I don't know, I've done very few things correctly when it's come to handling a crisis. But, John, we're out of time. I can't thank you enough to taking us down sort of a memory lane through to the end of our season. We're just about wrapping up the On Par Radio Show season. So it's always a pleasure to have you on and to sort of recap the season and to just talk golf in general. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Anytime.
All right, take care. That was John Huggan from The Golf Paper and Golf World. You can just a wonderful writer, and we're very appreciative of him joining us. We got to take one more break. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.
Pete's Golf. Since 1979, Pete's Golf has been practicing the art of club fitting and has been selected as a top 100 club fitter by Golf Digest magazine. At Pete's Golf, we use the best technology available to create an exceptional fitting experience for every customer that walks into our store. Visit petesgolf.com or call 516-248-6891. That's 516-248-6891 and get your next set of clubs fit for you.
All right, welcome back to On Par with Anthony Scorsia. I'm Anthony Scorsia. He is Steve Goldman. Steve, we got to go, but another great show, and always appreciate the musings of one John Huggin.
Huggy is always a good guest. He's you know, he doesn't pull any punches, and he's honest, and you know, and it wasn't surprising that the three of us were in agreement on a lot of the issues that we talked about, especially from the previous season.
Proof that he's a smart man. Agreeing with us is always
good. Well, I don't know about, maybe about golf, but I don't know about the rest of it.
Well, does there anything matter?
I guess that's true. It doesn't matter. Hey, by the way, John Rahm, first hole in one this year of the season. Morgan Hoffman, first double eagle of the season.
Double eagle? Don't you ever use that word again on this show. Albatross. Albatross. No such thing as a double eagle. I like you as a guest. I like you as my co-host. Gosh, I don't want to have to trapdoor you.
Guy shoots 3 under par on one hole, and he shoots 2 under par for the round. So there you go.
You can make it up quick. All right, folks, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Please see your local PGA professional, and please get fitted at Pete's Golf. You're listening to On Par with Anthony Scorsia.